The Jericho Network on Westwood One.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho, mama. Talk is me.
Welcome to Talk is Jericho. It's the pod of thunder and rock and roll, and we're getting our rock on today with a true heavy metal legend, one of my biggest influences as a singer, talking about Bruce Dickinson from Iron Maiden back on Talk is Jericho. And this time he's talking about his new book, What Does This Button Do? An autobiography. The book is all about his time with Iron Maiden, of course, and the 10 years he spent as an airplane pilot while in Maiden, and also the 10 years he spent away from Iron Maiden. He's going to tell all those stories, like the time he was almost shot down over Russia. He's telling some classic Maiden tales, why he left the band, what eventually brought him back, how they used to crash weddings and parties whenever they were on tour, more specifically the Polish wedding. Bruce is talking about the charity show he did in Sarajevo and the craziness about being nearly stranded in a war-torn country, playing gigs during a war. He talks about cutting off his hair, the initial fan reaction that he got after he did it. I know about that. And he's got details on the classic Iron Maiden documentary, Iron Maiden Behind the Iron Curtain. Saw it back in 1985. Still resonates in my mind. Lots of great stories from the legendary air raid siren himself. Bruce Dickinson returns to Talk is Jericho to push your buttons, and he's here right now. All right.
Hello, Bruce.
Hello, Bruce. How are you, my friend?
How you doing?
Good, man.
I'm very well. At last, I was sat there. I walked in and said, hi. I got a phone interview at 8 o'clock, and then this guy called up, and I went, I suddenly went, oh, no, it's half past eight, help, you know. So, it's completely my fault for being a goofball. Sorry about that.
Well, you're now an established, illustrious author, so I have to expect some of that prima donna atmosphere. You know, what I love about this book, and first of all, congratulations. It's a great read. And I'll tell you the reason why. I've written a few books myself, because you can tell that you wrote this book completely on your own.
Well, I'm very glad you can tell, which is great, because I wanted the book to be, you know, my voice,
right.
The authentic, like sitting down having a beer with me, you know, type read, basically.
Well, and that's the thing, too, because a lot of times when you read autobiographies, you can kind of, you know, someone uses a ghostwriter, that sort of a thing. But I noticed, like you said, it is like sitting down and talking with you, with your sense of humor and your little quirky little references and jokes and that sort of thing. It just makes it a lot more fun to read when you get that. Did you always have the idea of writing it by yourself?
Yeah, I was never going to go with a ghostwriter. I mean, I do know. No, there's one or two people who would probably have been, you know, quite sympathetic and everything, but it's always going to be their words and their take on things. And whenever I read autobiographies, which I don't do very often for that very reason,
mm-hmm.
There's always a bit somewhere that reads like a press release,
mm-hmm.
or it reads like how somebody thinks a rock singer ought to say something. And it's just like, you know, unless you've been there and done it, you don't know what it's like. So you have to do it yourself.
Yeah, as I always say, like, I'm too egotistical to allow somebody else to transcribe my story, because nobody can tell it the way that I can.
Yeah, and actually, that gives... You, if you do it yourself, you can nuance it so you get exactly what it was like to be in your head. The way I kind of put it is, it's a little bit like it's as if my, you know, as if I was just like being a movie projector, and I'm projecting what's inside my head onto the wall, and people can sit and watch it with me.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's interesting too, though. I find it like when you write a book and you do draft after draft and edit after edit after edit. After a while, and was it the same for you, when you're reading a story, you're like, I don't even know if this is good or bad. I don't know if this joke is funny anymore. You just start getting inside your own head where it's like, should it be the or should it be and? It's got to be and. No, it's got to be the.
I got to own up here. I didn't dwell on stuff
Mm-hmm.
So I used to go and I would settle down every day and I'd write about 1,200 to 1,500 words.
Mm-hmm.
And it would take me about 2.5 hours. And I would go straight through. And I would just go in the zone. I had a little notebook of the stories I wanted to tell.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'd get to the end of about 1,200, 1,500 words, and I used to handwrite them as well, so it's not typed. And then I'd just, it's like, that was it. Mojo's gone for the day. And I'd drink my beer and go, oof, there you go. And then I'd just move on to the next sequences, and I'd sort of daydream my way through the book. So there were no chapters
mm-hmm.
in the book. So it was just one. There's 700 pages of manuscript paper, and there's very few big corrections. The biggest corrections and kind of little rewrites of the old line here and there, and maybe half a paragraph or something, are all in the first, 20% of the book. The rest of it really was like a kind of stream of consciousness going down. And I wrote the book quite quickly. I mean, I didn't start writing the book until the middle of February.
Hmm. It's interesting, too, like for me, when you're writing a book, and obviously it's the same for you as well, the stuff that happened over the last 25 years is a lot easier to remember than the stuff that happened. You start out when you're a kid and then go into high school and go into when you were, going to college and all that sort of stuff and starting the bands. Was it harder to remember those early years? Like, I had to sit there for a long time and really dig deep, almost like a psychiatrist, and try and get into remembering those old memories.
I have a pretty strong, I have a terrible name. I have a shocking memory for names. I always have had.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a really good memory for descriptive things, as in like pointing a movie camera at a scene and seeing what I did. So, there are some hotels back on the Number of the Beast tour that I could tell you the color of the carpet and the pattern on it. And that's just a very strange thing to be able to do, I guess. But it's the way my recall memory works. It's very visual. So for that reason, once I got inside what stories I wanted to tell, and sometimes I'd forgotten some of the stories, and I went, oh, that was a good one.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow, I remember that. And sometimes I would sit and talk to people about the book, and as I was talking, I would recall things as I was going through it. I would go, oh, I better write that one down. That's a good one to go with, So the book ended up being actually a little bit over 160,000 words, and we took out about 35,000 words,
mm-hmm.
maybe more actually. I think we maybe took out 50,000 words, so maybe I wrote more than 160,000 words. But so we took us 3.5 days to get 50,000 words out of the book. Otherwise, it would have been 600 pages long and not 400.
But that's the hardest thing, though, trying to decide.
It does have to be an entertaining book, so you don't want it to be a doorstep that somebody's going to look at and go, "Oh my God, this is like War and Peace." It's got to be an entertaining read above all,
And it's hard too, because my first book was the same. I wrote 165. I had to get down to 130, and I found instead of having to edit out stories, you could just edit down like, okay, this story should not be 3 pages. I can tell the same thing in 1 page. Was that the same for you, or did you have to edit out chunks of the book?
We just took chunks. I just took chunks out. I mean, so for example, there was like three or four anecdotes about time in Samson, right?
Mm-hmm.
And each of them was very funny, but one after the other, after the other, after the other, suddenly it's not quite so funny. Because you've already done the laughs, and you need to move on to the next part of the narrative. And my editor, Jack, the fantastically named Jack Fogg, he said, look, he said, I want to edit this as if it was a novel.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got to keep the story moving. And the irony of it was that some of the early stories I'd written, some of the early episodes, if you like, at a very early stage in the book, he said, oh, I need to get these typed, something typed up so I can show it to some of the other publishers to show them what kind of a book it is and show them you could write and so on and so forth. So I typed up three stories, and each one, you know, 5-6 pages each. And I said, there you go. And they all went, oh, these are great. This is really funny. This is going to be a hilarious book. This is going to be terrific, blah, blah, blah. None of those stories ended up in the book. Because in the end, we had more stories than we needed. And we just said, sorry, this one here, we're just going to have to lose this. And I went, well, hey, you know, okay, I see where you're going with this. So the good thing about that is that I've got, you know, 35,000-40,000 words of episodic stories from all kinds of different eras, some of which can easily be, you know, repurposed into doing something else. But that something else wouldn't be for, oh, at least 2.5 years.
It's hard, isn't it, right, when you write a book? It's very mentally taxing when you're finished. You're like, oh, my God, thank God I'm finished with that.
Well, it was... I wasn't when I got done with it. I mean, I already had the last line of the book as soon as I wrote the title. You know, so I thought, well, that's a great way to finish the book, because it kind of it really is like press the reset button for the rest of your life. You know, after getting through the whole throat cancer business and starting to go on tour flying a 747, you know, so that, okay, that's a good place to stop.
Right.
But it still wasn't quite over, you know, because they said, look, have you got like a little story we can do just at the beginning of the book? So like a little chaser, like the first 5 minutes of a Hollywood movie, just something just to set the scene that it's just not your average rock and roll book. And I went, oh, okay, let me think about that, yeah. You know, so hence we ended up with the story about me nearly getting shot down over Russia with a couple of members of the British government on board.
Yeah, somehow you're flying some kind of a private, like you said, fishing trip or whatever it may be over the airspace of Russia, and they don't want you there.
Well, the fishing trip, I think the fish they were talking about may very well have been nuclear submarines, but, you know, seeing as they had FBI and personal equivalent of the FBI on board, armed to the teeth, and there were just these guys flying out to the headquarters of the Soviet Northern Fleet in Murmansk. And I was just working as a first officer with the airline I worked for. I mean, because I worked full-time for 10 years as an airline pilot, whilst I was in Iron Maiden, and nothing to do with Air Force One or any of that stuff. I mean, I was just a regular, had a job, you know, and part of my job was flying people off sometimes to some pretty weird and funky places, as well as doing what you might call normal passenger flying, but we were usually chartered in by other carriers. So, you know, if I was in the USA, for example, and was working for an equivalent carrier, they'd say, oh, American Airlines are short of an airplane for 6 months. You're going to be badged up as American, and you're going to be flying people to Cancun every day because they're short of airplanes, and so they're going to rent you guys. So that's the jobs that we did.
Mm-hmm. Which, that's what I love about your book, too, is once again, the title says it all. What does this button do? And at first, I was like, what does that mean? But I understand. It's like throughout your life, you've had all these different opportunities, and you're taking a chance. It's like, oh, what happens if I press this button? And what happens if I press that button? It's a great kind of tagline.
Well, isn't that what kids do? I mean, kids do that. You know, I mean, every child sees the world in a new way every single day. Mm-hmm. Nobody has ever seen the world the way that any child sees the world. that's what's amazing about being a kid, you know. I mean, you give babies, probably an unwise thing to do, give them a knife and fork. But I guarantee you that you'll be amazed at the number of different things they figure out to do with a knife and fork, anything except eat.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Because they see it in a new way, they play with it. It's like there's no restriction. And as for buttons and things like that, you know, you get a baby or a child or anything, and give him a load of buttons, and especially the button says, do not press this button. I guarantee you that's the first button they're going to push.
Right. And that's kind of a metaphor for what you did throughout your life.
It is absolutely a metaphor for what I did throughout my life. And I probably not like every single second of every single day, but at some point in your life, everybody has had a "what does this button do" moment that has just made them feel, "Wow, how cool is that? Look at that!" You know, I don't know what it is, whether it's kicking a soccer ball, whether it's, you know, throwing a pass to completion, whether it's doing something physical, whether it's writing, whether it's music, whatever it is, there's something somewhere that everybody can do that is going to really fire up the passion in them. And those are the things, that's what the book is a celebration of, I suppose. It's not about trying to, you know, settle scores with people that nobody else mm-hmm. has ever heard of or cares about, or about, you know, or all the bad sex you ever had in your life, you know, all that kind of nonsense. I mean, I said to somebody else, interviewer, they went, "Oh, there's not much, you know, sort of like sex and drugs and rock and roll." I said, "No." I said, "Really?" I said, "Do you want to know why?" I said, "First of all, because there wasn't that much. And secondly, it's kind of boring. You want to see, like, stuff that's funny? Go watch Spinal Tap and then go watch The Hangover. And that's all you need to know about sex, drugs, and rock and roll."
Yeah, that's all
there
I need
no
to know.
More.
That's all I need to know about touring
that's
in the 80s.
As stupid as it gets. You know?
Although there is...
I said, so,
go
what's
ahead.
The point? You know, it's far better, I think, to read about things that are, you know, positive and exciting and different, and things that celebrate life, not things that, you know, celebrate just basically just, you know, messing with people.
There is a great story in there that you just had a sentence of it, that you went and had a couple drinks and you ended up putting your wiener in the ear of the singer of Quiet Riot. That's a good
one. Yes, that's right, yes. I mean, again, you know, that's if that's as bad as it gets, you know, then that's okay. I did. There's a few bits of bad behavior in there, you know, just to demonstrate that we're not entirely choir boys, you know. But by and large, they're pretty harmless, and it's all it's good fun, even though it's you know, pretty stupid. There's a few we edited out actually that were a bit more debauched, and I was quite keen on one or two of them. I was like, yeah, really, couldn't we get that one in there? You know, right. The trouble is that they involved other people and other celebrities, and of course, you know, that opens up a can of worms, and all of a sudden the book all becomes about that story.
Well, yeah.
Because everybody's going to pick on that one story because it involves some other celebrity. So you go, actually, you know what? It probably is good to take a step back here, because you want to establish the book for what it is and get beyond that, you know, that sort of celebrity reality nonsense.
Well, that'll be the clickbait for the book too, right? If you go onto the websites and such, Bruce Dickinson said this about this person and that about that person, and that's not what you really, or the point of what the book is.
Well, and all of a sudden people think, oh, well, I'm not going to bother with this book, or they get the book and they think, oh, it's not like that at all, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So straight away I went, no, this is going to be an uplifting book. There was an English actor long time ago, long passed away now, a guy called David Niven.
Yeah, right? Sure, of course, yeah.
And, a very famous Hollywood actor.
Mm-hmm.
And he came out with an autobiography called The Moon's a Balloon. And I read it when I was a kid, one of the few autobiographies I have actually read, and I was absolutely riveted by it, because there was not a single nasty, mm-hmm. weird thing in it. But it was, his life was just this huge adventure from whether it was going out and, you know, going out and wrestling with Errol Flynn, or, you know, whether it was going and being in the army in the Second World War and being on special forces doing reconnaissance, but then he'd find, you know, a blown up wine cellar, and they'd just sort of go, well, let's just go and get drunk in the middle of the battle, and they sort of did, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And there's all these great stories, and I was like, you know what? This guy is telling a life that really has been lived, and he was loving life. And I thought, that's a book to aspire to, you know, because life is really, you know, life is all we've got. The alternative is, you know, inevitable, but not so great.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's interesting, too. I like what you said earlier, and it's something I learned from my books, is that you don't want to go and settle a vendetta or start a vendetta with somebody, because it's not necessary. If you look at the story of your life, no matter who was opposed to you or whoever pissed you off, it's like, in the end, you won. You got to do all these great things. So I always find that negative slant, well, you don't need it.
Yeah, no, exactly. And also, funnily enough, whilst I was writing the book, I had people emailing me saying, I hope I'm going to be well represented in the book. I didn't have the heart to email them back and say, I'm really sorry, but you're not important enough to be in it. You know. So it was strange, you know, those sorts of comments coming from people, and in truth, there's lots of things that get blown up out of proportion. In the press on occasions, and you think it's not really important as part of my life, so why bother with it in a book? It's just gossip. So yeah, let's just leave it. There are way, way more important things, way more important stories to talk about and things to tell. You know,
for sure. And then when you mentioned the adventure of David Niven, one of the stories that to me was one of the centerpieces of the book was your trip to Sarajevo. When you were doing the Skunk Works, I believe, in 95. And talk about this adventure that you had as the singer of a rock and roll band, but you are in the middle of a war zone and almost like a, I don't know, an underground mercenary at this point in time. What an adventure that was.
Yeah, that was a little strange, probably slightly unhinged thing to do, looking back on it. But it was a truly... what does this button do moment. I got a phone call, funnily enough, from the magazine Kerrang in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was out of Maiden, and I was sitting around at home, and they phoned up, and they said, we've had a request for somebody to do a charity show in Sarajevo. And this is in 1994, in winter, and there's a proper shooting war going on, and... it was the longest siege since Stalingrad. In fact, it was longer than the siege of Stalingrad in the Second World War. So there was no question that this was, like, you know, a pretty serious situation. So I said, what, are they out of their mind? And they went, no, apparently it's all going to be sort of sponsored by the UN, and you'll have all this protection and flak jackets and helmets, and you'll be helicoptered in, and you do the gig and they'll take you straight out again, and it's yeah. So, and it's all organized. And I went, okay, yeah, all right, why not? Mm-hmm. You know, what does this button do? And none of it was true. So we did get there on a military flight into Split, which was like 8-10 hours drive away, and then it all started to unravel, because the guy came up, the one of the British Army guys who was working for the UN, he said, look, he goes, the UN are scared that if you go and play a show in Sarajevo that you'll upset the Serbs, who don't like the Bosnians and they don't like anything that makes them happy, so here's your tickets, go home.
Hmm.
And I said, well, you know, I'm not really, I don't know about this quitting business, you know, are you sure there's no other way of getting in there? And we found a local cameraman who said, yeah, we can get you into this secret tunnel, you know, which I thought sounded quite adventurous.
Sure.
So I said to the guys, I said, well, why don't we stick around for a week? Because the next flight wasn't for another week to get us out.
Wow.
And I said, look, you know, we've got some gear. We could do a couple of pub gigs here in Split. It's a nice enough place. I'm sure the beer's cheap. We could find a floor to sleep on, you know. Come on, let's not just quit straight away. So we told them, okay, guys, we're staying. And at which point, everything changed. The guy made a couple of phone calls, and he came back and said, okay, so now you're nothing to do with the UN. We went, well, yeah, I guess not. They said, well, in that case, you must be something to do with the British Army. You must be our guests. I went, okay, this is sounding good, yeah. What's next? He said, well, come on down for a cup of tea, and we'll store your equipment, and we'll see if we can get you into Sarajevo. And so at midnight that night, along comes this soft-topped ex-military flatbed truck painted bright yellow with Felix the Cat, Roadrunner, and Asterix the Gaul on it. And they said, there you go, there's your truck, sleeping bags in the back, equipment in the back, two crates of beer, and off we went for 8 hours through the mountains in the fog, and we got hijacked by a couple of soldiers, and they were friendly, so it was okay, and then we went up to an active firefight, and then we drove into the city, and we did a gig. I mean, it's the story, it's all in the book, but
sure.
It was one of the most intense 5 days of my life. And I came back to London just before Christmas, and I had a five-month-old kid. I just looked at the world and life in a totally different way. Like, the Western world just seemed to be so absurd with our obsessions with red lights and green lights and traffic lights and do this and don't that. And I mean, and I've just come from a place where people can be walking down the street and get their brains blown out just for nothing, you know, just for being randomly killed, you know. I'm thinking, wow, you know, the world is really strange. But the wonderful thing about it was that we did it. We didn't actually, it wasn't like a Bono thing where, you know, the world gave us a new American Express card to give to everybody. We just did it. And 20 years later, I was in my local pub and somebody came up to me and said, hello, you don't know me. And I went, oh, no, it's going to be a selfie. It's going to be an autograph. It's going to be something. And they went, no. I want to show you a movie that the people of Sarajevo have made about your concert. I went, you're kidding me, really? And they've done this film called Scream for Me Sarajevo that's won all these, you know, human rights prizes and everything else. And it's, in fact, the mayor of Sarajevo actually was a kid at that concert.
Wow.
And it's the story of all the kids who were at the concert and how that one show changed their lives 20 years later. It's an astonishing film. So that's going to be released sometime next year, February or March, whenever we can track people down. But the filmmakers actually went, when I saw this film, I couldn't believe it, because I went, hang on a minute, you mean you found the truck that we drove in on and it still looks like that? And I went, yeah. And they found footage of the gig. They found all this cool stuff. And they tracked down all the people that you know, helped us in, helped us out. And I actually went back there. The guys who were in Skunk Works, they went back there on the 20th anniversary. Unfortunately, I'd just been diagnosed with throat cancer, and I couldn't tell anybody. And so I had to say, I can't really come. And they said, why can't you? I said, I've got to go into hospital for some tests. And, you know, you had to be really sort of like evasive. And I hated it, because it would have been quite nice just to say, yeah, I'd love to come. But I actually had a few more pressing issues on my mind at the time. So I went back a year later and did some filming for it, just some interviews. But it was an amazing, life-changing experience. It's all in the book, anyway.
Isn't it amazing how you never know who's watching you and who you influence after all these years of doing this? Like you said, the guy who grows up to be the mayor of Sarajevo was at your gig in 1994.
Yeah. You never know where life is going to... You never know where life is going to take you. You know, you never know whether, you know, hey, you know, should I turn at this T-junction, should I turn left? should I turn right?
Right.
You know, what happens if I turn left? And if you turn left, hey, who knows what might happen? Who knows who you might meet? You know,
mm-hmm.
So you never know. So I think everybody on the journey through life just needs to keep their eyes and ears and arms open, and just embrace everything you feel that you see. You know, and I think the world would be a much better place for it.
Another thing, when you're talking about the film in Sarajevo, another film that was really interesting to me was Iron Maiden, Behind the Iron Curtain, and you talk about that in this. I remember seeing this when I was probably 14 years old in Winnipeg, where I grew up, as you know. They played it on like the nightly video show. Here's Iron Maiden, Behind the Iron Curtain. It was a big special that they promoted for like a week. And the reason why is this was really, you guys were the first band to go to Poland and to Russia and these places. What an experience that must have been.
Oh yeah, it was. I mean, the strange thing was we had to drive in and out via some other countries as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like what was then Czechoslovakia, and I think we might have had to go through an East German border or something like that. But it was kind of spooky seeing trains full of Russian armored vehicles
mm-hmm.
just being transported up and down. You're thinking, wow, this is real. I mean, this is this stuff is just sitting there, and they're all pointing this stuff at us. You know,
mm-hmm.
no, this is the real deal. I mean, I early on, after I left school or was kicked out of school, you know, I joined the what would be like the Army Reserve briefly, you know, volunteer reserve, whatever, in the UK. And one of the crazy things was that our unit was supposed to be 24 hours call out, air portable, straight to the front line in the event that, you know, it all kicked off, you know.
Right.
And I was told that my life expectancy in combat was 1 minute and 45 seconds. I was like, oh, well, we'll get it over with quickly, I guess, you know. But it was chilling seeing that level of activity going on, you know. And yet, you know, it was six, however many years later it was, the war came down, and it all just kind of evaporated. It was a big front. It was a big facade.
Mm.
Nobody in those countries, nobody wanted to fight anybody. You know, all they wanted to do was just get on with people.
Right, sure, of course. Were you surprised at the level of Maiden's popularity amongst the kids that were there? Because they're fanatical.
Oh, Poland was extraordinary. You know, it was like the whole country was coming out to see you. You know, at times it genuinely felt like there was, you know, there was a bit of a revolution going on. You know, but it was clear that, you know, there was so much passion there, and the place that, you know, Poland now is not a depressing place at all. It's really resurgent, and the people are incredibly proud of their country and what they've done, and they're very inventive. And of course, there's loads of Polish people, you know, moved and come to England, and they work really hard, and they're, you know, really compatible with, you know, with you know, our UK society. Well, in my opinion, they are anyway.
Sure, yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So we, you know, I think we kind of get on pretty good as a pair of countries. But back then, it was the environment that the local Poles had to live in was grim. It was dull. It was grey, and it was all this Russian Stalinist architecture. You know,
mm-hmm.
It was all falling apart. It was all badly built. Nothing really worked. Everything was just, there were department stores, but there was nothing to buy. Mm. You know. And there was a legacy of the Second World War, which was still very much present. So, you know, the Russians had taken over the ex headquarters of the Gestapo in one town, and they turned it into a department store. But they hadn't changed anything. Walking around, and there'd be these funny little bits of German writing and sort of like, yeah, oh, torture chamber this way. Oh, no, sorry, it's the makeup department, you know. It's just really odd, really odd. There was some of the venues still had bits of the Nazi spy holes still hooked up so that the Nazis could have a look and look at the audience, you know, during the whatever meetings and rallies and stuff they had there. So it was kind of chilling, but that's pretty much, that's gone now. But it was still hanging around like a really bad smell when we went there. And it was almost like we were doing a kind of exorcism on all that, you know, rubbish that was old, geriatric, evil, nasty, black stuff hanging over everybody.
Do you remember the Polish wedding? Because it's on the video, but do you remember it?
Well, I do remember the. I remember the Polish wedding far more than I should, considering how much we'd had to drink. And there were loads of bottles of Russian champagne, which is very confusing stuff. Very sweet, very sickly. It gets you drunk, gives you a hell of a headache, and of course, lots of vodka. And I'd never really drunk frozen vodka shots before. So drinking vodka in that way really had a pretty profound effect on me for about a week afterwards. You know, like the world was actually pink. And I went, why is the world pink? And the answer is because your eyeballs are so bloodshot, the world is pink. So that was a lesson learned. But yeah, I do remember the Polish wedding. And it was not an altogether terrible version of Smoke on the Water.
It wasn't bad at all, considering the state you were in. So this is when Iron Maiden played at the Polish wedding. Did you guys just crash it, or were you invited, or how did that even come to play?
It was going on in the hotel, down in the like foyer of the hotel. Somebody's getting married, and there was a party and everything else. And the Poles are just really friendly, you know. So they said, oh, yeah, come on down. Yeah, he's coming down to the wedding, blah, blah, blah. Oh, you're a band. Oh, yeah, come on. Well, actually, I think we probably gate-crashed the band because we did, back in the day, we did that sort of thing. If there was a drum kit or something else, we could normally get drunk enough and Adrian would get up and start playing the blues and then Nico would, well, I'd usually get up and start trying to play the drums and then Nico would kick me off and, you know, and actually do it properly. But, yeah.
Another thing I enjoyed about your book, Bruce, was reading about your vocal influences, and a couple of the names you mentioned surprised me. I want to talk about that. But before we do, I want to talk about my physical fitness influence. I want to thank Diamond Dallas Page and DDP Yoga for helping me have one of the greatest matches of my career. Some people say it's the greatest match of my career, rated 5 stars by Dave Meltzer of the Wrestling Observer Newsletter, which is very rare. But I'm feeling great after the match last week at the Tokyo Dome in Japan. I took on Kenny Omega to the best of my abilities to have the best match of the night because DDP Yoga saved my wrestling career years ago. You know the story. If it weren't for DDP Yoga helping me overcome my back injury, I wouldn't be wrestling today. And if it wasn't for DDP Yoga helping me kind of loosen up after that horrible one-winged angel on a steel chair, I don't know if I'd be able to talk to you today, but I feel a lot better after doing the DDP Yoga energy program. I wouldn't be singing and performing with Fozzy either at the highest of abilities. DDP Yoga can help you live the healthiest life possible as well. If he can do it for me, you know he can do it for you. Just get the DDPY app for iOS or Android and get to work. The DDPY app is everything you need to get on and stay on the path to healthier living. I got the app on my phone along with all the DDP Yoga workouts. The app also tracks your weight, inches lost, and even takes pictures that you can see your flexibility, physiology, and core strength change from month to month. The DDPY app is a Bluetooth heart monitor. It tracks the calories you burn and even accumulates points based on how many workouts you do, then lets you redeem those points for prizes. It's got recipes, nutrition guides, even cooking shows. And like I said, I got the DDPY app on my phone. I like to do DDP yoga wherever I am, hotel rooms, backstage at various venues, on the bus in my living room. I watched the X-Files last night doing some DDP yoga in my living room.
So many places to do it, and you can do as many workouts as you want because there's over 100 of them, including a live workout every week from the DDP Yoga Performance Center in Smyrna, Georgia, the location where we filmed the Judas video, which has over 13 million views on YouTube. If you've seen the video, then you've seen DDP's Performance Center. Go stop in and check it out. And when you start with the beginner program, Dallas himself pops up every week in your app to help you map out your road to success and give you the support you need to own your life. The DDP Yoga DVDs are still available too. I like using them as well. I'm a little bit old school. And when you buy the DVDs, you get 3 months free on the DDPY app. That's free stuff. We all love free stuff. And right now, DDP is giving you 20% off the DVDs and the DDPY app. Just for you, the sexy beast listeners of Talk is Jericho. So just go to ddpyoga.com/Jericho. Take advantage of the sale. That's ddpyoga.com/Jericho. Change your life, own your life, get in the best physical and mental shape of your life, have the best match of your career at 47 years old and not even feel a damn thing. Do it with DDP Yoga. Start today. ddpyoga.com/Jericho. Make it happen.
Hey, this is Chris Jericho inviting you to the first ever Rock and Wrestling Rager at Sea. Picture this: rock and roll, wrestling, comedy, live podcasting, all on the open ocean from October 27th to the 31st, 2018, from Miami to Nassau. I'm bringing Hall of Fame wrestlers, some of the greatest rock and roll bands on the planet, and putting the first wrestling ring on a cruise ship ever. Don't be a stupid idiot. Make the list. Check us out at ChrisJerichoCruise.com.
Talk is Jericho.
Well, you mentioned Smoke on the Water, and one of the things that I really enjoyed about the book, as a lifelong Maiden fan and as a singer myself, was the three biggest influences on your vocal, which was Ian Gillan, which of course I knew, but the other two were kind of a surprise, which were Ronnie James Dio and Arthur Brown, The Crazy World of Arthur Brown. That was really cool to read your thoughts on that.
Well, yeah, I mean, all my secrets are out now, you see, so people can go, aha, I see where you stole that bit from.
Sure.
Oh, yeah, that little trill, that's like a copy of the one on Rainbow Rising when he does blah, 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 you know. And it's all true. I mean, I'm the first one to put both hands up and go, yep, guilty as charged. If you're going to borrow and if you're going to learn, you might as well learn from the best.
Well, the Gillan scream is quite obvious in a cool way, but the Dio I never realized before. But yeah, you got a lot of Ronnie James Dio in your voice.
What impressed me about Ronnie was that it just had this smooth delivery, but it just sounded like, you know, it was every time he opened his mouth, it was like, you know, like a few thousand, you know, galloping Mongolian horses came out of it. And you're like, how the hell does that sound come out of that little guy, you know?
Right.
But it did. And it wasn't quiet. You know, Ronnie, I mean, my voice is physically quite loud when it sings, as is Rob Halford's, as I assume is Ian's, and as is Ronnie's, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a generation of singers now that sound like they're singing really powerfully, but they've kind of trained their voices that they're not making a lot of noise.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they let the microphone do the work and all the rest of it. But in a room, if you put them in a big room and said, right, go and fill that room acoustically, it's probably, you know, not the thing. But I'm kind of old school like that, in that I always had the idea that if you're a singer, then you had to be able to fill a room, like for real, like without a microphone, you know?
Mm-hmm. Was it hard to kind of keep that power, for example, if you're talking like about the 80s, and you're talking about like the Power Slave tour, with the amount of gigs you guys were doing? And obviously you're in your 20s, you're in a rock band, I'm sure you're having some drinks like you mentioned. Was there ever times when you felt like, oh man, like how did you keep your voice powerful during all those shows?
Well, the truth is I didn't. I mean, it was very frustrating because we were doing a schedule that was, you know, pretty brutal, particularly given the, you know, the way I sing. You know, we're always a loud band, and we had terrible problems with monitors. We never really had a very effective monitor set up, and there was no real time to really get into it. There were no in-ear monitors. I mean, actually, I don't like them anyway. And of course, there was no recovery time for sickness either. So if you did get a cold, you had to sing through it. But we were doing 5 days on, 1 day break, 4 days on, 1 day break, 5 days on. So we're doing basically 5-4, 5-4, 5-4. When I first joined the band, there was a run of gigs that were like 8 one day, seven one day, six one day. We were doing like a two-hour show. I mean, that can only end one way for a singer. You know, your voice, you either destroy your voice or you destroy yourself. Mm-hmm. You know? So you've got to be smart, be sensible. Now, at the time, obviously, being young, you can push your body, but voices don't. You know, they don't like it when you don't get any sleep, when you're sick, when you're bouncing around and different. So you've got to kind of look after your voice more than you look after yourself, I think. Mm-hmm. But now, we now have a setup where, notwithstanding having the throat cancer thing and everything, I mean, I think I'm singing better now than I was in the 80s by a long way.
Mm-hmm.
And even though the voice, you know, sounds slightly different, you know, it's a little bit darker in tone. But we haven't changed any of the keys. We still sing all the songs in all the original keys. We don't detune or anything like that. Never have done. And frankly, we'll continue in that vein. You know, if we don't need to detune, I think the songs lose something if they're written in A440. You should play them in A440. There's a reason why they work in that key.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all the harmonics, all the notes, they all work in that key. And you drop it by half a step or whatever, and it just sounds kind of dirgy, you know. But what we're doing now is because the gigs are, every gig is completely crucial now because they're all big.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're all 10,000, 15, 20, 30, 40. I mean, we're doing one in Madrid. In next summer, it's already over 35,000 tickets.
Unbelievable.
And still selling strongly. And that's not, it's not a festival. It's our gig.
Yes, yeah.
You know, we could end up with 45, 50,000 people turning up just to see us, not mm-hmm. a festival. And you're thinking, you've got to be on top of your game here, boy, you know. So we do, you know, 3.5 to 4 shows a week. And that's nice. And the way we run it is that if we do two shows back to back, we have 2 days break to make sure we're back up to full power. So, you know, you do a show, day break. We can go on like that, so mm-hmm. you get a day of recovery. So it works out about 4 shows a week, and that's good. I don't like to do not many shows because you lose the momentum.
Yeah,
but you've just got to get it just right, you know.
Well, it's interesting because the last time we spoke, you had just come back from your throat cancer scare, and you were getting ready to go on tour, and you were saying you're just getting your saliva back and all this sort of stuff. And I saw you a couple months later in Vegas, at the very beginning of Book of Souls tour, and you started it on top of the pyramid singing it's escaped me now, the opening track from Book of Souls. Just it's a cappella vocals, you know, it's just you. And it was really cool to see, knowing that only months before you were still getting back in the groove of vocals. And then now here you are just belting out this tune all by yourself to kick off the show, to basically say like, okay, guys, I'm back and I'm doing all right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that thought did occur to me that I thought, you know what, this is a bit of a statement here. At the same time, it is, your voice is kind of warming up. It is the first bit, so you I kind of climb the ladder and sneak up behind what I used to call my smoking plant pot, you know, the steaming cauldron, you know, whatever.
Yeah, that's right.
My sacred plant pot there. But you stand up there and you do the opening line, you know, here is the soul of a man, you know. And,
yeah.
And you're thinking, oh, it's a pretty big statement there, you know, and you just hope that you don't screw it up.
Then it gets higher.
You screw it up really big, you know.
Well, that's the thing. You have no guitars distorted behind you. It's just you, man. You better be good.
Yeah. Better be good or better be bad. But either way is good, if you see what I mean.
When you're there's another thing I was going to mention before. If Eternity Should Fail, that's the name of the tune. I could escape my mind. I apologize. But I want to just briefly touch on the crazy world of Arthur Brown, because he was known, and not very well known in the States, but in England, a really crazy showman that always had different costumes and that sort of thing, which Bruce Dickinson always has during the course of the show. You're always doing different capes and jackets and masks and et cetera and that sort of thing.
Yeah, there's always been a bit of Party lurking in the background with me. And, I mean, when I first saw, I mean, I talk about it in the book about when I first saw Arthur. And it was really amazing. I mean, I just thought, oh, my God, I'm tripping, you know. But I wasn't tripping because I've never taken acid or anything like it ever in my life. But I thought, wow, this must be what it's like to, like, be on acid, because I can see the universe and Arthur, and it's so cool. I was 15 years old, and I was just having a massive sugar rush, basically. But, I mean, the excitement that I got, and his voice, oh, my God. I mean, it really was. It sounded like the voice of God.
Hmm.
He has this funny, like, you know, intonation that he does. But he's got the most extraordinary voice. And when you get into his career, it was a very, very eccentric, quirky kind of career.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of hit and miss and just very strange, but really wonderful for it, because it was all done in, it was all so experimental, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So in the days before digital, Arthur decided to have a band without a drummer.
Really?
So he had this thing actually called the Bentley Rhythm Ace, which obviously somebody's called their band that years ago. But the Bentley Rhythm Ace was actually a series of tape loops, mm-hmm, of drums, at which you would twiddle knobs and they would therefore start to turn at different speeds. So you could turn each drum to a different speed, completely analog, right? So there was no... You really had to play this thing, and the tapes would wobble and they'd be unreliable. But that was the rhythm section, and that was Arthur. This huge tripod with the microphone hanging down off it, and Arthur comes on dressed like a high priest. He has two keyboard players with Mellotrons, a VCS3 synth, which I don't know if that what that is, but it's the synth that basically all of Dark Side of the Moon, all those weird noises, that's all VCS3. Theremins, which was the world's first electric musical instrument.
Sure, yeah.
Electronic instrument, which is basically you play by waving your hand in the air, and was built as a it's basically a burglar alarm that was invented to protect Russian troops in the trenches in the First World War by an inventor called Leon Theremin. And he went, hey, I could turn this into a musical instrument. And he did. And effectively, if you listen to the original movie, The Day the Earth Stood Still by Robert Wise,
yes,
virtually the entire soundtrack is theremin. And as soon as you hear one, you'll go, oh, my God, so that's what that is. You think it's some weird violin, or you think it's some weird woman singing. No, it's a theremin. So all of this, like, big hodgepodge was Arthur Brown. So there he is doing his Voice of God, playing this mad drum machine with all these weird synthesizers going on, and suddenly a bloke comes on with a traffic light and starts beating somebody dressed as a brain. And you're going, okay, this is strange, but I like it.
Which led to you wearing lucha masks on stage and frog suits for Somewhere on Time tour. That was a good one. I liked the frog suit. That was fun.
Yeah. The thing with Arthur was that... The original album, The Crazy World of Arthur Brown, which has got the hit track on it, you know, the I am the God of Hellfire and I bring you fire, which people might have heard.
Fire, yeah.
That was only a three-piece band. That was Arthur singing, Carl Palmer from Emerson, Lake & Palmer on drums, and Vincent Crane, who went on to form Atomic Rooster, on keyboards and bass pedals. That was the whole band. So even that was a pretty strange setup. Pete Townshend of The Who was the executive producer, and the whole story is one of the world's first concept albums.
Oh, really?
And it's what led to Quadrophenia.
Oh, okay.
And Tommy, because the story of the album of Crazy World of Arthur Brown is basically, it's kind of Dante's Inferno. It's the story of a man's descent into hell. Okay. And he has a trip, and then he goes down into hell, and finally he comes up against the door and knocks on the door, and he's going, oh, it's so hot in here. Oh, let let me out. The door opens and this voice says, I am the God of Hellfire. And they, oh, right then, you've arrived. So it's a story of a man's descent into hell. So it's a pretty cool concept, you know, for 1967, I think it was.
Very ahead of its time, absolutely. Just as we wind down here, just a couple more questions for you, Bruce. A couple of things. You mentioned Maiden being bigger than ever, and there's a very interesting story in the book, and I can tell you played it close to the vest, but that meeting that you had in the pub with Steve Harris before you came back into Maiden back in 99 or whatever it was that kind of a secretive thing, like almost an espionage where you guys had to meet in a dark room, or how did that go?
Well, it was all a little bit strange because, you know, Rod is paranoid about, like, losing control over anything, you know,
course,
like
right.
getting out into the media, all this kind of stuff.
Come on, Bruce.
So we ended up, it was very odd. It was a sort of place that neither of us would normally be seen dead in. It was like a yacht club or something and some bar, and there was nobody in it except for the other guys in the band hanging out in the corner, and me and Steve, and you know, at first, it was a bit awkward at first because we hadn't seen each other by and large for 5 years, and I'm coming back and I'm like, you know, I'm trying to, you know, tread gently because there's no point in trying to talk about the old days or anything. Let's just talk about what we can do in the future, and we can, you know, we can rehash ancient history once we are underway, once we're really doing something. Because I think we both had to, you know, we both had some issues of trust going on here. You know, and so you've really got to give the other person space.
Mm-hmm.
So it was quite a fragile little moment, actually, and quite special. And he just said, look, why do you want to come back? And I said, because we need to make everything great again.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds like somebody else, doesn't it? I really didn't mean it like that.
Let's make Iron Maiden great again.
but it was one thing that, actually, it was Eddie Casillas from my solo band said to me. And I said to them, I said, they're going to ask me to rejoin Maiden. I know it. And I said, and when that happens, I said, my feet won't touch the floor. I said, and I'm not going to be able to do solo records with you guys and go on tour and stuff. And Eddie said, hey man, they said, that's cool. He said, you gotta do it.
Mm-hmm.
I said, okay. I said, why have I got to do it? And he went, because the world needs Iron Maiden, man.
Yeah.
And I went, yeah, actually, the world does need Iron Maiden. You're right.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really good reason. And so I just went in with that kind of attitude that, you know, we need to be back, and we need to be back properly, and we need to be back in ways that people don't even realize how good we can be and how far we can take this thing. Because I'd learned so much when I was outside of Maiden that I could bring back and throw back into the pot. And I think we'd all learned a lot, you know, even Steve, you know, with his experience of being, you know, when I wasn't in the band.
Right.
Everybody had learned so much. We'd all, you know, had a dose of the outside world, whether we liked it or not. And that rubbed off. And we're a much better band now, I think, than we were in the years before.
Was one of the caveats for you to come back was to bring Adrian back?
Yeah, I mean, it was always... Adrian coming back was never going to be an issue.
Gotcha.
Because... one of the first things that Steve said, he said, he always wanted three guitarists anyway. Because there's more than enough guitar parts to play.
That's
the
truth.
And Adrian is just really integral to our sound, you know. I mean, so, you know, Adrian and Dave together, I mean, what a beautiful setup, you know, on all those, you know, first few albums we did. But then, you know, when Adrian left, you know, Yannick had actually been in the band for longer than Adrian had been in the band when Adrian came back.
Right, yeah.
So that Yannick had kind of established his own niche as well.
Mm-hmm.
So now we had three little niche guitar players here, so let's play around with it. And, of course, it meant that we had a lot more songwriting firepower as well.
Sure.
You know, so in actual fact, the songs started getting, divided up in a much more kind of round-robin sort of way.
Right. Well, that was your songwriting partner, too, is always Smith Dickinson writing those tunes that, that you guys put together.
Well, no, I mean, obviously I used to write a lot with Adrian, but then on Seventh Son I wrote with Steve, and then, you know, everybody's just writing a little bit with everybody else, you know, which is, it's nice, you know, it's how it should be.
Good chemistry. Two last questions. When you left Maiden, I always wondered this. They put out a single for Hallowed Be Thy Name, and there's a picture of it in the book from the live record, and Eddie is actually running you through with a pitchfork in hell. It's like Bruce's. Did you know about that?
I think that was probably Rod's idea. Yeah, I was like, thanks. Yeah.
Did you know?
Back for that, you know.
Did you just see it one day?
No, I didn't know. Of course, I didn't.
What did you think when you saw it?
I thought, I bet you think you're pretty clever, Mr. Smallwood. Yeah, don't worry. So that's when I decided to design Edison, just to wind him up.
Edison was the guy on the cover of Accident of Birth, the crazy clown?
That's right, yeah. And he freaked out and was jumping up and down, saying, "Oh, it's Eddie's son." I went, "Hey, no, it's not. Edison, he invented the light bulb. Look, he's got three broken ones on the top of his head. It's a bright idea." Yeah.
It's drawn by Derek Riggs,
like,
but it's just a
crazy. Me on Hallowed Be Thy Name. Yeah. That was a clever idea.
Last question is something I've dealt with for years. I was always known in the 2000s when I was wrestling for, I had really long blonde hair, and then one day I made the cardinal sin of cutting it. To where it's like, how can you still be Chris Jericho with short hair? And I loved your description of when you cut your hair and the reason for it. Did that surprise you, the reaction that you got, that you had cut your famous hair?
But it didn't surprise me. But, you know, honestly, I think people got over it extremely quickly. You know, it's like, really? It's like hair thing. It's like, this is like super important to like the music or whatever. And, maybe for one or two people it was. But I think, you know, now the world has moved on where if you want to have long hair and your long hair looks great and you're happy with it, have long hair. If you want to have short hair, have short hair. It's like, it's not prescriptive, guys. You can be whoever you want to be now, as long as the music's cool and it's real and it's authentic and it's you, that's all that matters.
I loved how you said, though, you looked at the promo picture of the band. You saw three young guys and one old guy with straggly long hair.
Yeah, that's right. Well, there comes a time. I mean, Jesus, like, ascended into heaven age 33, right?
Right.
At 33, most people, really, that's kind of cutoff point for being Jesus. And after 33, really, you start to look like a homeless person. You know, so maybe that's a good time to stop.
Bruce, it's so great to talk to you, man. And once again, your book is great, and congratulations on that and your health and everything like that. Are you guys back out again this summer?
Oh, yeah. We're going out for basically 3 months in Europe this summer, and it is going to be an amazing show. We've got a top. The last show.
Oh, yeah.
I honestly thought that last tour we did, if somebody had come up to me at the end of the last tour and gone, "Hey, tonight is not the last night. We're going to do another month and a half," I would have gone, "Yeah, bring it on," because I was having the best time of my life on that tour. Anyway, that was the end of it. That was the end of the Book of Souls tour, and we were already planning the stage set. As the last notes were dying away for this next tour. Mm. And we were agonizing, going, what the heck are we going to do? How are we going to really change the way people look at the set and change the way people look at us and make this next tour really cool? I really think we might have done it. It's going to be really special. The set is going to be really special. The physical set. But also, I think the actual songs we're playing are going to knock people's socks off.
What's your favorite song to sing nowadays? Do you have one?
My favorite song off which album? Sorry?
Off any album. What's your favorite song to sing live?
Just one. Jesus. no, that's not a song.
It could be.
Wow, on the spot. Well, I'll be honest with you. I do like the nice proggy ones because they you can really get stuck into them, you know. Mm-hmm. So Rhyme of the Ancient Mariner, Sign of the Cross.
Ooh, interesting.
Seventh Son, you know.
The long ones.
And Blood Brothers.
Ah, oh, great tune, man, great tune. Well, Bruce, thank you so much, man. I appreciate you calling, and I'll see you this summer somewhere down the road.
Yeah, you certainly will.
Cheers, man. Thanks, Bruce.
Thanks, Chris. Cheers.
Thanks again to the legendary Bruce Dickinson. His new autobiography is called What Does This Button Do? It's a great read, written by Bruce, as we talked about, and you can really hear it in his voice. It's a lot of fun, a lot of great stories. You can get it wherever you buy books, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, your favorite local bookstore, Kindle. Just go check it out, and also check out Iron Maiden this spring. The Legacy of the Beast Tour kicks off in Europe on May 26th in Tallinn, Estonia. They have dates scheduled through August. Get your tickets at ironmaiden.com. What's the set list going to be like? Because the last show was heavy on the new stuff, which means they're going to do a tour heavy on the old stuff. I'm excited. What kind of nuggets are they going to play? Still Life would be great. Prowler, Phantom of the Opera would be a lot of fun. They've played that recently. How about Alexander the Great? That would be cool. I'd like to hear that. Or what else would be fun to hear? The Prophecy. How about that? That'd be pretty obscure. Infinite Dreams. Back in the Village. Come on, Maiden. Open up the vaults and play some obscure tunes. Once again, get those tickets at ironmaiden.com, and also get the Fozzy tickets at fozzyrock.com as we hit the road in Europe, joining Steel Panther starting January 28th in Paris. We're heading all across Europe. Then we'll go back to the United States starting February 28th in New Orleans. We've got Through Fire, Santa Cruz, and Dark Sky Choir coming along to rock with us. We're doing over 30 dates in the U.S., going all the way from New York City to Los Angeles and everywhere in between. So go check out FozzyRock.com for all the cities, dates, venues, and ticket information. You know we're doing the VIP meet and greets as well, so get in on that before they sell it. Nobody does the VIP pre-show like Fozzy. We give you a whole mini concert, take requests, meet you, take pictures with you, sign your stuff. It's one of the best in rock and roll, great value. Get your tickets at FozzyRock.com and check out the Fozzy VIP experience at FozzyRock.com as well. And remember, there's still a couple days left to make the list on Chris Jericho's Rock and Wrestling Rager at Sea. If you book your cabin by this Monday, January 15th, you take a picture with me and the list. I'll even put you on the damn thing. People say, how do I get on the list? Here's how you do it. Book your cabin before January 15th, and I will put you on the list at ChrisJerichoCruise.com. Remember, we set sail October 27th, and for as little as $150, you can reserve your cabin. And when you do that, everything is included in the price, all-inclusive, all the food, all the activities, live podcasts, stand-up comedy shows, rock and roll shows, meet-and-greet, signings. All of this is included in the price of your cabin. All you pay for is alcohol and gambling. Plus, you get to see the whole Sea of Honor tournament free of charge and get to meet all of the great legends and up-and-comers coming on the Rock and Wrestling Rager. Jim Ross, Jerry the King Lawler, SoCal Val is our special cruise director, Mick Foley, Ricky the Dragon Steamboat, Rey Mysterio, Keeping It 100 crew with Conan, Disco Inferno, and Shane Helms, Beyond the Darkness telling some scary tales with Tim and Dave, Don Callis and Paul Lazenby will do a live Killing the Town podcast, Colt Cabana and Marty DeRosa doing their unprofessional wrestling show. It's very, very funny stuff. Brad Williams, Ron Funches, Jim Brewer, speaking of funny, three of the greatest stand-up comedians in America today. Jim's going to be rocking with his band, The Loud and Rowdy, as well. Great rock and roll band. Busted Open Radio will be there. Dave LaGreca, hopefully Bully Ray as well. Phil Campbell and the Bastard Sons. Fozzy with Painless being top 40 now. We're hotter than ever. King is going to be with us. The Stir is going to be with us. The Dave Spivak Project. Speewee's been on the show. Go check out his new video, Get Out of My House, on YouTube now. The Darlings of Rock and Roll, the Cherry Bombs, will be there. Shoot to Thrill, the world's greatest female tribute AC/DC band. Blizzard of Ozzy, the world's greatest Ozzy Osbourne cover band. And, of course, Ring of Honor presenting the Sea of Honor tournament aboard the ship. Matches happening in the middle of the ocean on a ring in the middle of the cruise ship. And the winner of the Sea of Honor tournament gets a Ring of Honor World Heavyweight Championship shot in the future. Young Bucks will be there. The Villain, Marty Scurll, Cody Rhodes, the Briscoe Brothers, Dalton Castle, Frankie Kazarian, Adam Page, the beautiful Brandi Rhodes. So many more being announced in the upcoming weeks. Speaking of being announced, coming up on Wednesday, all right, my former best friend Kevin Owens and Sami Zayn return to Talk is Jericho. Nothing but laughs and stories and a great time. So be here Wednesday for me, Sami Zayn, Kevin Owens. Until then, stay hard, stay hungry, peace, love, and hugs, and a big yeah, boy!